So, we are discussing about King Bharat, who left his kingdom in search of spiritual life in order to establish his consciousness at the lotus feet of Krishna without any hindrance and disturbance. King Bharat gave up his kingdom and went to the forest on the bank of the river. What's the name of the river? Gandaki River. And what is the name of the ashram where Bharat Maharaj went to? Who remembers? Very good. Pula Ashram. So then unfortunately Bharat Maharaj became attached to a deer in the forest, and that destruction caused him to fall down. That attachment caused his mind to become distracted from the lotus feet of Krishna, and he forgot his spiritual activities. He started to neglect his spiritual activities due to his attachment to the deer. And then, at the time of death, Bharat Maharaj left his body thinking about the deer. And as a result of that, what happened? Who knows? He became a deer. He got the body of a deer. Why did he get the body of a deer? Yeah. So whatever one thinks at the time of death, he gets that body. Therefore one should be very careful to prepare himself for his death. Like nowadays we see people are becoming so attached to their dogs. And due to the attachment to their dogs, what will happen at the time of death? Who they'll think of? They'll think of the dog. And as a result of that, they'll get a dog's body. So one should actually be very careful about where he develops his attachment. Like if our attachment is for the wrong thing, then our whole life's mission will be lost. Now the question also may arise that why does it happen? Why should one get a body according to the thought at the time of his death? The answer to that is, the last thought while we leave the body is going to be wherever our greatest attachment is. In this body, wherever we developed our greatest attachment, that will be the last thought. Sometimes we hear, especially in India, people say, well, at the time of death I'll remember Krishna. But the unfortunate thing is that we can't say that at the time of death we will think of this or we'll think of that. Because will, which actually directs our mind, will not function at the time of death. What to speak of at the time of death? Even when we are asleep, can we use our will? Can we think before going to bed that tonight I'm going to think that I've become a millionaire or I've become a king? We may desire, but there is no guarantee that we will be able to think or we'll be able to dream about that. So we notice when we fall asleep, then will doesn't function. When we are awake, then we may use our will, but not when we are asleep. Similarly, at the time of death, we won't be able to utilize our will. We can't say that, well, unless we have prepared ourselves. But even then, we can't actually direct our will at the time of death. At the time of death, our consciousness will take its natural course. And wherever our greatest attachment is, that will be our last thought. If somebody is very attached to his wife, then at the time of death he'll think of his wife. If someone is very attached to his children, then at the time of his death he'll think of his children. If someone is very attached to his pets, then at the time of death he'll think of his pets. But if someone is very attached to Krishna, if someone can develop his attachment to Krishna, then at the time of death he'll think of Krishna. Therefore, it has been advised in the scriptures that while we are alive, when we have our ability to use our will, then we must utilize our will to develop our attachment to Krishna. So all we have to do is develop our attachment to Krishna. We cannot think that mechanically or by some means we are going to think of Krishna at the time of death. It don't work. All we have to do is develop our attachment, which means we have to develop a love for Krishna. So if we can develop a love for Krishna, then, and if Krishna becomes the dearmost object of our love, then it will happen automatically. If Krishna becomes the dearmost object of our love, then at the time of death, we'll think of Krishna. So Bharat Maharaj's life, or not one life, three lives actually in a row, is very, very exemplary. It's very important for us to think about quite deeply and learn the lesson from him. He was a king, gave up his kingdom. It must be very, very difficult for a king to give up his kingdom and walk out onto the street. I mean, whatever little possessions we have, we find it so difficult to give it up. We can't give up our attachments. It's very, very difficult. There is a saying that even a beggar is attached to his begging bowl. All he possesses is a begging bowl, and he's even attached to that. So, this is how the attachment is, and it's very difficult to give up that attachment. And those who can give up their material attachment, they are fortunate. So Bharat Maharaj was very fortunate. And how did he do it? He did it out of his wisdom. Because he knew that the ultimate goal of life is not this material possession. Even though one may be a king of the entire earth planet, which Bharat Maharaj was, he was the king of the entire earth planet, but gave up. Similarly, Rupa Goswami, Sanatana Goswami, they were the ministers, they gave up their attachment. Raghunath Das Goswami was the son of a king, gave up that attachment. Narottam Das Thakur, another son of a king, gave up their attachment at a very young age. Narottam Das Thakur left home when he was only about 16, 17 years old, and the son of a king just left everything and ran for Vrindavan. So similarly, Bharat Maharaj also gave up his attachment, but unfortunately he became attached to a deer. In spite of giving up everything, he finally became attached to a deer. And although he attained a very, very elevated position in devotion, a very, very elevated stage of his devotion, where he was experiencing the bhavas, the ashtashatrik vikars, the eight ecstatic symptoms due to his love for Krishna. That is the stage of bhava, stage just before prem. So anartha nivritti, nishtha, ruchi, everything, he's crossed all those stages. Anartha nivritti, like he was free from all his unwanted attachments, unwanted impediments, anarthas. So he transcended that stage. He became situated on the platform of fixed up devotional service. Mind was not wavering to anything else. And then he developed the taste, ruchi. And then after the ruchi stage, where after developing spontaneous attachment to the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he came to the stage of emotion, experiencing the transcendental emotion for the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And at that stage one experiences these symptoms, trembling of the body, standing of hair, tears, choking of voice, fainting. But even from that elevated position of devotion, he fell down due to his attachment to a deer. And as a result of that, in his next life, he got the body of a deer. But although he got the body of a deer, he remembered everything from his previous life. As a deer, Bharat Maharaj was a Jatishmar. He could remember the activities of his past lives, what happened to him in his previous life. And he learned a big lesson. He didn't want to make the same mistake again. So although he was in a deer body, he started to perform austerities, and he was taking advantage of sadhu sangha, association of saintly personalities. He left his dear mother, and he went back to Kulaharsham on the bank of the river Gandaki. And there he used to associate with the devotees, with the saintly people. There were many saintly people at that place. Not many in the sense, there were some saintly people practicing a spiritual life in their huts. Krishna then. They're living in their, residing in their hearts, and they used to practice the spiritual life. And then Bharat Maharaj, although he was in a deer body, but he was taking the association. I'm sure he could understand when these people used to discuss about Krishna Katha. He must have been sitting there listening to them. And actually there are many animals like that, those were spiritually advanced, and for some, due to some slip in their spiritual life, they got an animal body. I often remember about one experience. In Vrindavan we were doing parikrama, one Ekadasi. On Ekadasis in Vrindavan we used to do parikrama of Vrindavan. And right after Mangalarati we used to leave, and we would do the parikrama of whole Vrindavan and come back before the deity greetings. It takes about 2.5 hours. And one day there was a dog, he just joined us also in the parikrama. And he was very happily walking ahead of us. And sometimes other dogs would come and try to chase him or try to bark at him. But this dog, at that time, when the other dogs attacked him, then he would just walk in within the devotees, and then the dogs were helpless, so they would go away. And that dog, all the way throughout the parikrama, he walked with us. And then he finished the parikrama, and then the dog disappeared. We didn't see the dog. So we have to understand that these are very, very special souls. Although they may be in a dog's body, but they must have been a devotee in Vrindavan due to some problem, due to some fall down. They got into a dog's body. But actually he's a devotee. And he knows the importance of doing the parikrama on Ekadasi day. And so he did the parikrama of Vrindavan with the devotees. In Tirupati, Udipi, there used to be an elephant who used to carry the deities. Actually, the temple, there are many elephants for carrying the deities, and the elephants used to have a competition. Like they used to have race, and whoever would win the race would be able to carry the deity on some particular occasion, when the deity goes out on the back of an elephant. And this elephant was desperate to win the race so that he could carry the deity. So finally, when the time came for the elephant to leave his body, he just broke open from there, ran in front of the deity, and he knelt down in front of the deity, looking at the deity, he left his body. And the murti of the deity is still there in front of Tirupati temple, in that posture, looking at the deity just as he was about to leave his body. There are so many such instances. So Bharat Maharaj, although he was in a deer's body, he remembered everything from his previous life. And he didn't want to make the same mistake. And then in his next life, he was a pure devotee. He was born in the family of a Brahmin. And he, knowing well how dangerous material attachments can be, Jada Bharat, from his very childhood, became very careful about not to become attached to anyone, not to become attached to material life. And he, in order to guard himself from such possibility, he pretended to be a deaf and dumb and a retarded person. And everyone thought that he was a hopeless case. His father tried to make him study the Vedic scriptures, learn the mantras, but he used to desperately pretend as if he can't understand anything. And then I mentioned the other day how his brothers, after his father's death, exploited him. But Jada Bharat was completely unperturbed. Then the dacoits caught him and wanted to sacrifice him in front of Kali. Still then he was not disturbed. Even at the face of imminent death, he was unperturbed. And when they were about to sacrifice him in front of Kali, then Kali personally appeared from his deity, from a deity. The deity of Kali shattered into pieces and she came out. And she picked up the chopper and started to chop the heads of those dacoits. That's how the Lord and his devotees protect the devotees. The devotees don't care about their protection. Just as a little baby doesn't care about its protection. No, it's just as a little baby is completely surrendered to the care of the parents, and they know that the parents will take care. Similarly, a devotee is completely surrendered unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In this respect, there are two examples. One is the example of a monkey and example of a cat. Cat, mother cat, carries the baby cat from one place to another. Did you see how the cats carry the kittens? How? Bite onto the neck, the back of the neck, which is the most delicate part actually. When a lion or a tiger or even a cat kills its prey, do you know where it bites onto first? At the back of the neck, the spinal, the joint, the spinal, the base of the spinal column, just after the brain center. And they bite into it and kill the animal. So when a cat kills an animal, cat kills a rat, It grabs him on the back of its neck and just snaps its neck. And the cat's teeth are very, very sharp. And for a rat, cat's teeth are death personified. But with the same teeth, the mother cat bites onto the back of the kitten's neck and carries by the kitten. Kitten is completely carefree. He's happy. Oh, my mother is now taking care of me. So this is the surrender of a devotee to the Supreme Personality of God. Although a cat is death personified to other animals, but to the baby cat, she is the greatest and the warmest shelter, most secured shelter. Now another example is a monkey. The baby monkey, I'm sure in South Africa there are plenty of monkeys and you have seen. Did you see how what does the baby monkey do? Just clings on to the mother. And the mother jumps from one tree to another. You've seen the baboons, yeah? Like in here you see the baboons holding on to the mother baboon. And the mother monkey jumps from one tree to another. And the baby monkey just holds on to the mother. And this is how secured he is. So a devotee surrender to the Lord has got two aspects like this. One is total surrender, and other is to hold on to the Lord's lotus feet with all one's might. Never let go. In the history of the monkeys, there has never been a case when the baby monkey died while the mother monkey was jumping from one tree to another. Not a single case. They hold on to the mother so tight. So similarly, a devotee holds on to the lotus feet of Krishna. And if we can surrender unto Krishna with that kind of faith, and if we can hold on to Krishna's lotus feet with that kind of sincerity, then we'll never fall. So Jarabharat, he was attached to the Supreme Personality of Godhead and depended upon the Supreme Personality of Godhead with that kind of conviction. Even when the dacoits were about to kill him, he was just like an innocent little child, with full confidence that whatever my mother does, whatever Krishna does to me, that's fine. If Krishna wants me to die, if Krishna wants me to be sacrificed to Kali, fine. Or if Krishna wants to protect me, he will protect me. If he wants to kill me, he will kill me. It is not that the devotee thinks that, well, Krishna will protect me all the time. No. Devotee thinks that Krishna knows what is good for me. So if Krishna wants me to die, I will die. Or if Krishna wants me to stay alive, then I'll stay alive. If Krishna wants me to stay alive, then nothing can kill me. And if Krishna wants to kill me, then nothing can save me. So why go against Krishna's will? Just become tuned up to Krishna's will. And with that faith, with that conviction, a devotee carries on his devotional service. Then at one time, there was a king called King Rahugana. He was going to Kapilashram. Kapilashram is where the Ganges meets the ocean. That is where the Kapil Muni's ashram is. And they say Kapil Muni is still present there. So this king was going to Kapilashram, riding on a palanquin. You all know what a palanquin is? Do you get palanquins in South Africa? But you know what it is. Palanquin is a wooden structure. And a person sits inside and it has a pole connected to it, large pole, wooden pole connected to it. And people carry it on the back. So one person, one or two persons sit down inside and the bearers, they carry the palanquin. So at one time they needed one and another palanquin bearer. So they found Jadabharat, a sturdy looking person just loafing around. So the head bearer got him. Said, look, come, you carry the palanquin for the king. So Jadabharat didn't protest. And so he was engaged in the service, which is not a very difficult job. You simply have to walk. If you're strong enough, if you can carry the load, then you walk. And but one thing you have to know while carrying a palanquin is to keep the pace with the other bearers. Now, Jadabharat, while he was walking, he was also seeing ahead of himself, 3 feet ahead of himself, before placing his foot. Because he was concerned if there is some living entity and if he stepped onto the living entity, then unnecessarily he would kill the living entity. So he didn't want to do that. And since he was walking like that, his movement did not tally with the movements of the other bearers. And as a result of that, the palanquin began to swing. And the king started to feel very uncomfortable. So he said, he called the bearers and said, what's the matter with you? Carry it properly. So then the other bearers became afraid that if the king is angry, then the king will punish us. So they all pleaded not guilty. So we are carrying it fine, but there is somebody who is not actually walking according to the pace. And so the king became very insulted. The king saw that it was Jadabharat. So he became very insulting towards him. In a very sarcastic way, he told him, let me read that. Okay, I'll just read from here. King Raghugana could understand the speeches given by the carriers who were afraid of being punished. He could also understand that simply due to the fault of one person, the palanquin was not being carried properly. Knowing this perfectly well and hearing their appeal, he became a little angry. Although he was very advanced in political science and was very experienced, his anger arose due to his inborn nature as a king. Actually, King Raghugana's mind was covered by the mode of passion, and he therefore spoke as follows to Jadabharat, whose Brahman effulgence was not clearly visible, being covered like a fire covered by ashes. Actually, Jadabharat was a Brahmagyani. He was situated in the Brahma Buddha platform, he was a Brahman realized personality. And a personality like that are naturally effulgent. One can see the Brahma Jyoti of a Brahman realized person. So, but Jarabhara, because he was hiding his identity, one could not see his Brahman effulgence. Just as fire, as if a fire covered by ash. So now King Rahugana therefore could not recognize Jarabhara's exalted position. He considered him to be an ordinary person, not even an ordinary person, he considered him to be a fool, an idiot. That's what he thought him to be. So King Rahugana told Jarabhara, "How troublesome this is, my dear brother. You certainly appear very fatigued because you have carried this palanquin alone without assistance for a long time and for a long distance." He's being extremely sarcastic towards him. So he's speaking like that. "Besides that, due to your old age, you have become greatly troubled." Jarabhara was not old. He was quite young. But he is being sarcastic. "My dear friend, I see that you are not very firm, not very strong and stout. Aren't your fellow carriers cooperating with you?" In this way, the king criticized Jarabhara with sarcastic words. Yet, despite being criticized in this way, Jarabhara had no bodily conception of the situation. He knew that he was not the body, for he had attained his spiritual identity. He was neither fat, lean, nor thin, nor had he anything to do with a lump of matter, a combination of 5 gross and 3 subtle elements. He had nothing to do with the material body and its 2 hands and legs. In other words, he had completely realized his spiritual identity, Aham Brahmasmi. He was therefore unaffected by this sarcastic criticism from the king. Without saying anything, he continued carrying the palanquin as before. Thereafter, when the king saw that his palanquin was still being shaken by the carriers, he became very angry and said, "You rascal, what are you doing?" First he was sarcastic, and now he became gross. He just started to call him names. "Are you dead despite the life within your body? Do you not know that I am your master?" "Are you disregarding me and are not carrying out of my order? For this disobedience, I shall now punish you just as Jamaraj, the superintendent of death, punishes sinful people. I shall give you proper treatment so that you will come to your senses and do the correct thing." Thinking himself a king, King Rahugana was in the bodily conception and was influenced by the material nature's mode of passion and ignorance. Due to madness, he chastised Jarabhara with uncalled for and contradictory words. Jarabhara was the topmost devotee of the dear abode of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Jarabhara was the topmost devotee of Godhead and the dear abode of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Although considering himself very learned, the king did not know about the position of an advanced devotee situated in devotional service, nor did he know his characteristics. Jarabhara was the residence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He always carried the form of the Lord within his heart. He was the dear friend of all living beings, and he did not entertain any bodily conception. He therefore smiled and spoke the following words. Although Jarabhara was insulted, he didn't take it seriously. He smiled. Because the devotee, since he is transcendental to his bodily conception of existence,
He doesn't mind if somebody criticizes him or praises him. He simply remains unperturbed. The great Brahmana Jaramharta said, "My dear king and hero, whatever you have spoken sarcastically is certainly true. Actually, these are not simply words of chastisement, for the body is the carrier. The load carried by the body does not belong to me, for I am the spirit soul. There is no contradiction in your statements, because I am different from my body. I am not the carrier of the palanquin. The body is the carrier. Certainly, as you have hinted, I have not labored carrying the palanquin, for I am detached from this body. You have said that I am not stout and strong, and these words are befitting a person who does not know the distinction between the body and the soul. The body may be fat or thin, but no learned man would say such things of the spirit soul. As far as the spirit soul is concerned, I am neither fat nor skinny. Therefore, you are correct when you say that I am not very stout. Also, if the object of this journey and the path leading there were mine, there would be many troubles for me. But because they relate not to me, but to my body, there is no trouble at all." So in this way, Jarabharata spoke to the king. First he spoke and explained to the king about the distinction between the body and soul. The difference between the body and soul. So that was the first thing Jarabharata spoke. Then the king realized that Jarabharata is actually a very exalted personality. The way he spoke, he could realize that, and then he became afraid that he committed offense to a great devotee. And he begged forgiveness, saying that these offenses to a devotee is extremely dangerous. He says that, I'm not afraid of different weapons of different demigods. I'm not afraid of the punishment of Jamaraj. I'm not even afraid of the trident of Lord Shiva. But I'm afraid of committing offense to a Vaishnava." I'll read those two verses also. "Whatever," now this is King Rahugana saying, "whatever you have spoken appears to me to be contradictory, O best friend of the distressed. I have committed a great offense by insulting you. I was puffed up with false prestige due to possessing the body of a king. For this, I have certainly become an offender. Therefore, I pray that you kindly glance at me with your causeless mercy. If you do so, I can be relieved from sinful activities brought about by insulting you. O my dear Lord, you are the friend of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is the friend of all living entities. You are therefore equal to everyone, and you are free from the bodily conception. Although I have committed an offense by insulting you, I know that there is no loss or gain for you due to my insult. You are fixed in your determination, but I have committed an offense. Because of this, even though I may be as strong as Lord Shiva, I shall be vanquished without delay due to my offense at the lotus feet of a Vaishnava." So then, okay, so now Jarabharata is instructing King Rahugana. He's saying, let me see. Okay, let me read from here. as long as the mind of the living entity is contaminated by the three modes of material nature, goodness, passion and ignorance, his mind is exactly like an independent, uncontrolled elephant. It simply expands his jurisdiction of pious and impious activities by using the senses. The result is that the living entity remains in the material world to enjoy and suffer pleasures and pain due to material activity. Because the mind is absorbed in desires for pious and impious activities, it is naturally subjected to a transformation of lust and anger. In this way, it becomes attracted to material sense enjoyment. In other words, the mind is conducted by the modes of goodness, passion and ignorance. There are 11 senses and 5 material elements, and out of the 16 items, the mind is the chief. Therefore, the mind brings about birth in different types of bodies among demigods, human beings, animals and birds. When the mind is situated in a higher or lower position, it accepts a higher or lower material body. So according to the state of our mind, we actually take our body. Like when somebody's mind is in a lower state, when one's mind is degraded, then he gets a body also which is degraded. He gets a degraded body. When the mind is elevated, then one gets an elevated body. Now what it actually means, yeah, let's consider that. What it actually means, when the mind is, according to the state of our mind, we actually get our body. That's what King Bharat is telling. Jarabharat is telling King Rahugan. So who can elaborate on this point?
That the subtle body carries.
Very good. Right. So mind is actually the subtle body. Although subtle body has three different, subtle body is made of three different elements. Mind, intelligence and false ego. But general identification of the subtle body is made as the mind, as Jarabharata is making here. He is talking about the mind, but what he is talking of is the subtle body. And according to the state of now, as one acts, accordingly his subtle body takes the shape. Like as one acts, that is how his subtle body becomes. For example, we see that sometimes we do something good and our automatically our mind feels elated, isn't it? And when we do something bad, although no one actually saw us, but our mind feels heavy. Doesn't it happen? So in this way we can see that how our activities affect our mind. Also, sometimes don't we say that somebody is like an angel and we say someone is like a pig. Why? Because when someone acts like a pig, we say that man is like a pig. When someone acts like an angel, we say that he's an angel. And literally his mind, his subtle body takes up the shape of an angel or a pig according to his activity. And according to the shape of the subtle body, one will accept his next gross body. Say a person who acted like a pig all his life, his subtle body actually has taken the shape of a pig's subtle body. And now he has become ready to get the pig's gross body. So after he dies, what happens? The subtle body, by the arrangement of nature, carries the spirit soul into the womb of a pig. And there he is awarded with his new gift and the body of a pig. And in due course of time he comes out with a pig's body. So in this way, according to our mind, we actually get our body. And of all the material aspects, mind is the most important.
Like 16 considerations are made here, 16 items of our material existence. Our material existence has, sometimes it's considered 24, sometimes it's considered 16. So here the consideration is made of 16. Like what? 5 knowledge acquiring senses, meaning, what are the knowledge acquiring senses? Very good. Eyes, ears, nose, touch, tongue and skin. And then there are 5 working senses. What are the working senses? Hands, the legs, the anus, belly and genitals. So 5 and 5, 10. And then there are 5 elements of the material nature. There, earth, water, fire, air, ether. And then we have 1 internal sense, mind. So 3, 5, 15 plus 1 is 16. And of all these elements, which one is the predominant, or which one is the chief? Mind. So mind actually controls everything else. And very systematically, Jarabharata is explaining that to King Rahula. When the mind is situated in a higher or lower position, it accepts a higher or lower material body. The materialistic mind covering the living entity's soul, carries it to different species of life. This is called continued material existence. Due to the mind, the living entity suffers or enjoys material distress and happiness. Happiness and distress is experienced by who? Not by the soul. It is experienced by the mind. Because the consciousness in the material direction is projected through mind. And how does the mind experience again? Mind experiences through the senses. This is called continued material existence. Due to the mind, the living entity suffers or enjoys material distress and happiness. Being thus illusioned, the mind further creates pious and impious activities and their karma. And thus, the soul becomes conditioned. The mind makes the living entity within the material world wander through different species of life. And thus the living entity experiences mundane affairs in different forms as a human being, demigod, fat person, skinny person and so forth. Learned scholars say that bodily appearance, bondage and liberation are caused by the mind. When the living entity's mind becomes absorbed in the sense gratification of the material world, it brings about his conditioned life and suffering within the material situation. However, when the mind becomes unattached to material enjoyment, it becomes the cause of liberation. So, in this way, Jarabharata made King Rahugana realize that what actually is the cause of our material bondage. And the cause of our material bondage is our mind. And then he further explains, but basically, and this is, or maybe you can just consider the last 2 verses in this chapter, because that kind of sums it up. The soul's designation, the mind, is the cause of all tribulations in the material world. As long as this fact is unknown to the conditioned living entity, he has to accept the miserable conditions of the material body and wander within this universe in different positions. Because the mind is affected by disease, lamentation, illusion, attachment, greed, and enmity, it creates bondage and a false sense of intimacy within this material world. This uncontrolled mind
is the greatest enemy of the living entities. If one neglects it or gives it a chance, it will grow more and more powerful and will become victorious. Although it is not factual, it is very strong. It covers the constitutional position of the soul. O King, please try to conquer this mind by the weapon of service to the lotus feet of the spiritual master and the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So how to conquer the mind? So he is actually pointing out that there is the best weapon to conquer the mind is the service to the lotus feet of the spiritual master and of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So this is how one becomes free from the bondage of mind. Okay, so all glories to Srila Prabhupada. Does anybody have any question?
Like we said last night from the example of Subharagami, that one develops material attachments due to offense. So what was the offense that caused Maharaj Bharat to become attached to the idea?
I haven't found any mention of that. But what Prabhupada actually mentioned is that this Bharat Maharaj, it was not actually a fall down. It was Krishna's arrangement for freeing Bharat Maharaj from all his past karma just through this one body. Like all his past previous karmas were burnt out in the body of a deer. So it was actually Krishna's arrangement.
He had so much karma to work through.
Yeah.
And it took him a whole life in the body of a deer.
That's why, you see, our prayer is Mama Jambani Jambanishwari Bhavatad Bhakti Arita. What's the big loss if we can make it in this lifetime? Mahaprabhu himself is praying life after life. So Mahaprabhu is teaching us how to pray to Krishna. That we do not want liberation. All we want is to remain engaged in your devotional service. That's the prayer of the devotee. And if one is engaged, if one has the opportunity to become engaged in the service of the Lord, then it is as good as being liberated. Like we can consider it this way, that since the time we joined the movement up till now, is it getting better or getting worse? I mean, if we fix up in our devotional service, it gets better. So, at least the assurance is there that if we remain in devotional service, then it will continuously and increasingly get better and better. And then how many lifetimes it takes doesn't matter. But as long as we keep on moving towards that direction, to the lotus feet of Krishna, that's all we care for. And devotees don't desire for liberation. Devotees simply want service, because service is better than liberation, or greater than liberation. So that's a good way to think. Like if it was so difficult for the Bharat Maharaj, such an advanced soul, I mean, what chance do we stand? So we shouldn't become conceited and think that, oh, now we have become pure devotees. Yes, we have been very fortunate to come to the platform of pure devotional service. But now let us endeavor to remain in that platform and take full advantage of that. What's that?
The subtle body.
Yes.
It's the quality of the soul, because we were talking about earlier that you pointed me out to that. Is that the quality of the subtle body discarded, or is it actually evolving to the different?
Actually, for a devotee, the subtle body gradually wears off and the spiritual body becomes manifested. The subtle body is a covering. Just as this gross body is a covering, the subtle body is also a covering. The difference between gross body and subtle body is that at one point we discard the gross body, give up the gross body, and after we die. But that the gross body dies, but the subtle body doesn't die. You see, it's not that at one point we just give up the subtle body and, you know, wake up in our spiritual body. No, the subtle body is transformed by the process of devotional service. For example, what's the subtle body made of? Mind, intelligence and false ego. Now what is devotional service? Devotional service is to think of Krishna with the mind. Right? Mana mana bhava. Devotional service means Krishna consciousness. Think of Krishna. Now as we think of Krishna, the mind becomes purified. You see, the mind becomes spiritualized. And in this way, when the mind is fully engaged in thinking of Krishna or in devotional service, then what happens? Dadami buddhi yogam tam. Krishna says that I give him buddhi yoga, the spiritual intelligence. Jena mamupo jantite. So by being engaged in devotional service to Krishna, our intelligence becomes purified. So buddhi, which is intelligence, becomes buddhi yoga, becomes spiritualized intelligence. And in this way, when we become fully absorbed in Krishna consciousness, then what happens to false ego? The false ego then becomes purified and we recognize our real identity. So false ego becomes our swarup. You see, false identity becomes is transformed into a real identity, which is Jiveh Sharup Hai, Krishna Nityadas. So this way, mind, intelligence and false ego, they actually become transformed or spiritualized. And that is the stage of Jivan Mukta. I think James was asking a question the other day. Now, what happens to a person who is a pure devotee but still in this body? So that stage is called Jivan Mukta, meaning that although he is alive in this body, but he is mukta, he is liberated. Because within the gross body, he doesn't actually have a subtle body. What he has is a pure spiritual body, a pure spiritual self. So within the apparently material gross body, the spirit, pure spirit soul is dwelling. And it's just a matter of time. It's just a matter of time when the term for this body is over. When the nature says, okay, now go. And then he just leaves the body and goes back to the spiritual sky.
Whereas in the third canto it's described how the liberated soul leaves this material world. It traverses the Milky Way, goes through the Sushumna planet, through all the different seven colors.
Well, that is not all liberated souls. That's just the yogis.
That is the house of the planets where the body has absorbed the sun.
Yeah, right. There's a difference between a yogi and a devotee. You see, a yogi makes his own effort, whereas a devotee simply depends upon Krishna. To give an example, the difference between a yogi and a devotee. A yogi is a person who is trying to become a millionaire. Right? He's working hard to make a million. And a devotee is like a prince. Just by birth, he's a millionaire. Just by being a son of a king. Now, which one is better? So that the yogis do, you see, like, what the yogis do, they make their own arrangements. How they are going to get out,
specific time and through specific course, you know. But, you know, first of all, it's a very, very difficult course, difficult process. And therefore, the chances of succeeding is very, very little. Whereas in devotional service, there's no loss. Anyway, I mean, what was your main point?
No, I was wondering how that applied to a devotee.
It doesn't apply to a devotee. A devotee doesn't make his own arrangement. Devotee simply depends upon Krishna, Guru and Krishna.
We're discussing how Bharat Maharaj followed even from the platform of Bhakti. So I was wondering, that's even beyond like Ruchi, where you get some genuine taste, or, you know, genuine. So how come he was getting pleasure that was sufficient to drag him away from this pleasure of Ruchi? Just that pleasure from a deer, how could the pleasure that he got from the deer?
Yeah, so here we have to understand that it is, here we have to understand that Maya is very, very strong. And Maya can actually bewilder a living entity. Even up to the stage, even up to the point of Bhava Bhakti. Only at the Prema Bhakti stage one is completely 100%, 100% protected or 100% safe. But otherwise, even up to Bhava Bhakti stage, he is susceptible to Maya. But in Prema Bhakti stage, there, the Krishna's internal potency takes over completely. But up to Bhava Bhakti stage, the internal potency is still not fully functioning on the living entity. Therefore, he is susceptible to Maya. And how Maya comes, there is no way of knowing. It's very, very difficult to figure out. Like, Maya can come in so many.
Guru Maharaj had another question. One day I was having a discussion with another devotee, and I was telling him, if the person has prasadam even once, then next birth we'll get a human body. But also, then he replied, what about yam yam bhakti swara? You know, in other words, what do we become the moment of death? So, you know, such a person, they just take karmi, and he won't be thinking of Krishna at the time of death. So how can he get a human body?
I don't know. Like, only thing I know is that Krishna's potency is inconceivable. How it works, you know, we don't know. Just like the prisoners in the prison can't figure out how the king can release a prisoner. But since the king is the master of the prison house, he can release anyone, whoever he wants to. Or he can award any benefit to any prisoner. But for a prisoner, it's inconceivable how it's possible. Okay, so I'll stop now. Thank you all very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nikki, how are you doing? Do you have any questions?
No, most of it will actually be answered in May.
So were you comfortable yesterday?
Very.
You had a good night's rest?
Yeah.
Hare Krishna. I hope you'll have a nice day here.
I'm sure I will.